Now playing select cities.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennon.
And I'm Arlene Englehart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. Well, we have a pretty exciting show planned today. But before we get into it, I'd like to remind you that you don't have to wait till 9 a.m. to hear Democracy Now! You can hear it every morning at 8 a.m. on our HD3 channel, The Source. You can hear it online at WMNF.org/listen. That's Democracy Now! Weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on WMNF's The Source and 9 a.m. on our main channel, right before From a Woman's Point of View. And then it's replayed on The Source at 5 p.m. every weekday afternoon.
And then I'm excited because this weekend, Sunday, August 19th, 2 to 6 at p.m. at Gulfport Casino, I think this is really exciting. We're going to celebrate our homegrown heroes, an afternoon of art, activism, and accolades. And they're going to celebrate homegrown heroes, honors organizations throughout Tampa Bay who are sowing the seeds of equality, peace, and social, economic, and environmental justice here at home. And I don't think there's ever been a more important time for us to rally around our local heroes and to realize that you do have a lot of power. In fact, you're the only one that really has the power, and we need it so desperately now. So I think that's a great new event that WMNF is doing. And I am very, do you have any other announcements you wanted to make, Arlene? And I'm really excited because with us in the studio now is a young woman that I know so many of you are familiar with, all her great work she's done here in Florida. We are glad to welcome back to the show Jackie Lopez, and she is the Florida director of the Center for Biological Diversity. And so, Jackie, welcome back to the show. Oops, well, let's put you on mic so people can hear you.
Hey, good morning.
And we're just got to talk a little bit about the green and the reds around here. Everyone else might be into the blue and reds, but we're into the green and reds right now. And so, Jackie, I hope you had a good week last week and got some R&R, but this isn't a surprise, is it?
No, this is pretty predictable at this point that we have these outbreaks of algae, toxic algae coming from Lake Okeechobee, fueling what's happening offshore, the mass casualties of wildlife, the complete destruction of our coastal economies, and hopefully this year enough will be enough and we'll get some real meaningful change. It seems like we have momentum toward that. Governor Scott just announced a relief package declaring a state of emergency for Florida. But, it's not really, an emergency suggests that maybe it was not a preventable or predictable event, but in fact it is. It happens. It's been happening with increasing frequency over the last few years, and it's something that we really need to start meaningfully addressing.
Well, it's not really rocket science. I mean, really, it's not. I mean, if you're going to let all these nutrients go in a relatively still body of water and filter its way down, and you're going to also allow all the things that are in that, all the nitrogen, all the phosphates, from all kinds of aspects, whether it's farming or ranching or people, and then with the kind of global warming we have and in that huge body of water, and then they're doing repairs on the dike, and so they have a limitation how high it can be now, and I don't think that's projected to be done until 2020, who knows when, right? Because they've got problems, honestly, it's kind of like, what can one expect? But I think that's, and as you, instead of for biological diversity, because Florida is such an extraordinary state. I mean, it really is. It's a combination of many different aspects of geography, if you will. And it's almost a shame, and to the total disdain, particularly we have, to our water. And so right now, declare an emergency, fine. So what exactly is that going to mean? I mean, what does that mean? Are they going to try and clean up some of the blue-green algae? What does that mean?
That's right. So it's a reallocation of funds to local communities to help them get through the crisis. So when you have a big event like this, like what we had with Deepwater Horizon, and there was an environmental crisis, the first thing that gets affected, at least in terms of our economy, is our ecotourism. People don't want to come party in toxic guacamole, and they stay away, and that affects our local economies. And so part of the relief package goes toward helping those local businesses and municipalities deal with cleaning up the mess that's been made, not preventing future messes. So, you know, one thing that could be done differently, and I guess it's important to take a step back and realize that this is a crisis a century in the making. You know, if you can find a map of Florida from the 1850s, it's beautiful. You have Lake Okeechobee, which was this wide, vast lake that slowly spilled into the Everglades, which was many times larger than the size that it is now. And it would slowly trickle down to the bottom of the state, carrying along with it all the nutrients and all of the things that now get bound up into this lake that's been diked. And it was diked to allow agriculture, and the agriculture has attracted urban development. So now we have to keep a dike in there. We have to keep the artificial confines of the lake there to protect people and property. And it has created an artificial plumbing. So we really did turn what was once a beautiful, functioning, world-class ecosystem into a toilet. And so we have Kissimmee and we have agriculture using it as the toilet. When we have times of drought, everybody sticks their straw into it and tries to get fresh water from it. And when we have times of high water or hurricanes or events where we have to release the water quickly, we treat the Caloosahatchee and the St. Lucie like the plumbing. Mm-hmm. And we just push the water out there, and we don't care what happens to those ecosystems and communities that live along those water bodies. And so to really change that, a few things need to happen. We need to get very serious with ourselves and consider some really major land reform, including taking back some of that land around Lake Okeechobee, returning it to its original purpose, which isn't necessarily storage in a conventional bathtub sense, but a functioning ecosystem. And that requires a lot of political will, which Florida has been lacking. And the other thing that we would need to do is really address water treatment. So like you said, it's a slow-moving, stagnant body of water that has a legacy of pollutants, and then we flush that out. We need to get a better handle on how we treat the water going into the lake and how we treat the water coming out of the lake before we push it down the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee.
Well, you sound so sensible. Isn't it a shame that politicians don't seem to have that same sensibility? Because we really are talking politics here. I mean, was it last year that, you know, the Lake Okeechobee was scheduled to be cleaned up, so to speak, and they postponed that for 20 years? 20 years. You think, what? You know, and I'm curious, what kind of cleanup, remediation, do we have even a viable scientifically? I know people have suggested, and I think they've done some, at least some laboratory studies, so to speak, of red tide with ozone, with promising results. Now, I don't know how close that is to actually being able to work out, you know, to actually apply it real data, so to speak. But what kind of remediation do they have, or is there any?
So we have a big problem with agricultural runoff. We have other sources of runoff that affect our freshwater ecosystems, but it's the nitrogen and the phosphorus that ends back up in our water, which fuels the toxic blue-green algae. You know, the blue-green algae and even the red tide, the algae that makes up red tide, these are things that occur naturally mm-hmm. in the environment, but are fueled and become these mega villains because of what we do to our water. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that we can do is look at our best management practices for agriculture and see what's working and what's not working, because so much of what we apply in terms of fertilizers are ending up back in the water and are fertilizing these bacteria and these algae. And that's a big source of our problem right now. Now that's in addition to and connected to the high volume of water. So we have the Army Corps of Engineers that's managing Lake Okeechobee levels during high water periods mm-hmm. and for purposes of protecting human health and safety and property, it has to release the water from the lake. But the lake, that outer bound is 15 and a half feet. So you can go down, the Corps manages it down to 12 and a half feet. You could probably go even lower than that, so that when we have periods of drought, we understand and anticipate that there's going to be drought. which has become less predictable with climate change, but we have water there for the ecosystem services we need, the species that need the water and the habitat, and the municipalities that rely on Lake Okeechobee and the discharges, or you know, the releases down to the different rivers. But then at high water periods, we are anticipating that there is going to be a high water period and the lake is not as full, so that we don't have to use these emergency valves. And instead of using them in true emergencies, you know, the way maybe we could, we now just rely on them as this is the principal means of getting rid of a lot of water quickly.
And so, again, we're talking to Jackie Lopez, and she's the Florida director for the Center for Biological Diversity. And so, Jackie, you just mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers. Is part of the problem here that there really isn't a unified, so to speak, agency that really is in charge? I mean, in other words, when you've got politics involved, if you split it up into many different pieces, that's even more inefficient. Is that part of the problem, too?
Well, certainly, and in this case, a big issue is that when the water levels drop below 12 feet, the jurisdiction reverts over to the Water Management District. And then the Water Management District has a separate, it's within the same regulatory regime, but it has separate responsibilities for managing the lake level there and dispersing water among the different water users. So agricultural users, municipal users, and you know, the environment is considered a user of the water as well. That gets sort of second class citizen treatment.
And what about also when Scott also changed the requirements? Because I think a lot of people in Florida actually have septic tanks. And so it's important that those are actually functioning well. And so he changed the rules as to the checking for that. And so is that something that also has to be addressed?
So nitrogen from septic is something that has been traced in particular in the Indian River Lagoon. So it does have, it plays a role. It's not a principal role, but it is one of the fixes, while expensive, is politically not a challenging fix. It's technologically not a challenging fix. So it is one area that we should be considering low-hanging fruit that we could at least address a small percentage of the total loading of these water bodies by, you know, ensuring that existing septic is not leaching and prohibiting additional septic loading to those to that region.
And I'm curious, are there any methods to clean up that blue-green algae? I don't mean instead of taking the necessary precautions, because the kind of precautions actually will have many ramifications that we don't even know about. You know, in other words, that only benefits us. And to me, it's always been amazing that, you know, if you create a waste, it's unbelievable to me that you just throw it into the river. You know, I mean, to me, that should be at the source. It should be taken care of. And so it's not a problem to anybody. And to me, that just makes common sense, almost precautionary principle, if you will. But I'm curious, because I know that many fuel companies have tried to use blue-green algae for a, you know, a fuel source for energy. And so, and I don't know, that might be as bad on a community as, so to speak, fracking. I have no idea the processes involved. But is there any, because when you have this amount of a blue-green algae, if it could be harvested, you know, sustainably, so to speak, is that part of are people even looking into that or not?
Well, that would be a fantastic silver lining. It's possible that they are. I'm not as familiar with that. You know, what we know happens right now with all these algae issues when we have a big boom of algae is that once they've consumed all of the available nutrients, they die off. And then that deprives the water body of oxygen. And that's when you see the big fish kills and that are not directly related to the toxicity in the case of the cyanobacteria, but just because of oxygen deprivation. And that's what happens with red tide as well. But no, that would be wonderful if there are folks out there looking at ways to turn around this environmental disaster and put some of this waste product to good use.
And now many people are really worried about the blue-green algae, and they see it in their canals or the rivers, et cetera. And so how dangerous is it really to people, and particularly their pets? What should they be concerned about?
So in humans, we know that the exposure to cyanobacteria can have gastrointestinal effects, can have respiratory effects, and can affect your skin. And so you want to make sure you stay away, stay indoors, or stay away. And the same is true for pets and wildlife. You know, probably everybody who's on Facebook or any kind of social media, or even, you know, sees the news, has seen the the carnage of these events, and you know, having a whale shark be, you know, turn up dead, and having, you know, dozens and dozens of dolphins and sea turtles, and these are really, these are big animals.
Yes,
you know,
and
so we're not even seeing all of the smaller fish and the, you know, the crabs and the smaller wildlife that are no doubt being affected as well. And so the toxicity, the longer term toxicity, is also something that people are concerned about. You know, possible connections to ALS and Parkinson's.
Now that is fascinating, particularly with the red tide.
Mm-hmm.
I have been following that with the 12 dolphins. They've done necropsies on a lot of them, and their brains are just loaded with actually the same substance that's in Alzheimer's and ALS. And I think it's a BMAA, beta methyl L-alanine, and I thought, whoa. and you know, that some of the scientists said, you know, that they have seen some of the, not just the dolphins, but the fish, and they say they seem to be paralyzed. You know, they might still be alive, but it's just barely. And they said it really seems to be they don't have control of their fins, etc. And I thought, well, now that is fascinating, because, you know, the ocean and water are just not our natural habitat. And so in a way, all of life kind of comes from that. And to me, it was absolutely fascinating that that toxin, I think it's a brevetoxin that comes out of red tide, that it would affect the CNS like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, because I know many researchers on particularly Alzheimer's have tried to link it to a bacteria that you were exposed to long, long, and they've all kinds of things, you know, mad cows disease and others. That, in other words, they're a little offbeat type of bacteria like we have now, but bacteria are so much ahead of us in a way. They're so smart. They really are, you know, very lean livers, but they're smart. And I was just fascinated with that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying, and it exemplifies, in a way, the unknown and unintended consequences of our actions, and, you know, to be so cavalier with our environment. And I think, you know, even the wisest and best intended among us see something like the ocean and see its vastness.
Yes, it just,
and it symbolizes purity, you know. So I think we take for granted its ability to heal itself, and to know now that this tiny, you know, microscopic thing can be so life-altering and have that potential on an individual or on even on a species as a whole, should be really scary to us, and we should pay attention to it, and we should be demanding more of the people that we put in office to carry out the will of the people.
Yeah, and with the red tide, I've really been fascinated, really following it, you know, the neurotoxin particularly aspect of it. And I was really interested because, as you said, I mean, they've reported red tide outbreaks in the 1500s. I mean, you know, and why it's offshore and why it comes in and just what is involved in this. And long before the development all that came, they were having it. And I thought it was so fascinating. I think it was in 1947. They had such an outbreak. That's when they found out it released a neurotoxin, because the people in Naples and in those towns, you know, were quite sure that the army had released nerve gases into the ocean out there. There was golf in there, and they were quite certain that they were being, you know, poisoned by neurotoxins from the military, and not this case. And I thought, well, that is so amazing to me that the toxin would be produced that is such a neurotoxin. And I thought, wow, I thought, you know, we just don't understand it. And you have to have the respect for it. And rather than saying, well, you know, we totally don't know, we would say, well, you know, I'm just going to make an arbitrary assumption here and maybe do a study that it's related to all these increase in nutrients, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think all of us are terrified of Alzheimer's or ALS or any degenerating disease like that.
That's right.
And you think, heaven forbid, if there's any chance that that could be involved, we've got to take this seriously.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, compounding the issue with the nutrients being loaded into Lake Okeechobee and then pushed out the rivers and then into the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic, we have the Gulf of Mexico that's warmed 2 degrees in the last 40 years.
Wow.
Now,
that's excessive.
That is amazing.
Wow, that's dangerous.
And so it is difficult to parse out, oh, is it, you know, climate change induced warming of the Gulf waters that's contributing to the increasing frequency of the red tide events? And or is it the nutrient loading and pollution that's coming out into our coastal waters that's feeding and drawing in the red tide? It's probably both. does it matter if we parse it out exactly? Like, we could be doing better on all fronts, and probably for the sake of humanity, we should be doing better on all fronts.
Well, and, you know, this should be a state that really leads this country with bioengineering in the sense of understanding ocean life, et cetera. And every one of our major universities, in my opinion, should have a really extensive department that's studying these kind of things, because we really need them to be studying and say, what's happening here and why is this happening? And we need this kind of independent analysis, because obviously the politicians are not doing the job. And, you know, as people, we have to say, whoa, you know. You have got to be more responsible than this. But really, to me, it's just unimaginable that University of Miami, University of Florida, all of them, you know, USF has very good marine biology, et cetera, but the kind of research, and then it's heartbreaking to see what happened, particularly under Scott's administration, you know, that the science and the research were just cut, and the fact that you can't even mention climate change was frankly despicable in this day and age when we see constantly the really serious problems that we just need better information and just more sensible regulations, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, regulation shouldn't be a bad word. You know, it's common sense. It's protection. It's necessary because, like, you know, this is what happens when you don't have adequate regulation or regulations aren't enforced. You have environmental catastrophes.
Sure.
Where everybody pays this consequence. And so, you know, we need to take back common sense, really. it's weird to be saying it, but it's true. Like, if you're going to be in a position to be polluting a shared resource and you're not voluntarily, completely, adequately mitigating for that, which we know never happens, then there needs to be regulations to ensure that for everybody else's health and safety, for the economy, for all these other things that are so connected, so blatantly connected.
Yeah, almost a sense of the commons, if you will. You know, and frankly, the quality of our water in every way is the commons. I mean, we're 70% water. We're water beings. It's a water planet. And, you know, water doesn't have boundaries. And we have to recognize that, and I think that kind of, you know, sense of responsibility and the hands, you know, the hands across the sea or whatever they were just last Sunday, you know, that you realize that people love these, you know, they love their water here. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons people live in Florida. But we can't have politicians that are not paying attention and, frankly, maybe serving other interests. That because it's critical to our health. And somehow to me, to have 300 tons, you know, and I also, I guess I wonder, I think, well, you know, the toxins are really in these fish, et cetera. And I thought, you know, how are they going to disperse of that? You know, I mean, what happens if you, are they going to burn it? Are they going to bury it? I mean, in other words, that's a breath of toxin, and I've been kind of concerned that, you know, particularly this woman down in Naples is with the EPA, but she lives there, and she said she was just going out looking. You know, she didn't touch anything. She was smart enough, and she made sure her dogs, kids weren't anywhere near it. And she said she was just getting down, and she was just taking a stick and kind of just turning things over and seeing what she was dealing with. And she said she got so ill, and she was so ill for 2 days, and she said she had never, you know, she's been around red tide a lot. She studied various aspects of it. And I think that, I, you know, when it's people like that that are really professionals, you might say, and they're alarmed by the degree of intensity, obviously, and I don't know whether that was the neurotoxin, probably, but I don't know. And that should concern us all when professionals like that are saying, this is really, really serious, and it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And so I just think that the alarm bells are there, and at 300 tons, but I don't know if anybody is really thought about those issues. Like, I want to know, well, how are they going to get rid of them? And, you know, will there be a neurotoxin discharge? And, you know, that's, anyway, lots of areas to think about. And I know, Jackie Lopez, you are. And so we've kind of quickly gone through this. Are there any other aspects, particularly of water, that you'd like to mention right now?
Well, I think just to reiterate the points that we've been talking about, that we just need to be demanding more. I mean, we should all be outraged that the crisis has reached this level. It's unfair. It's unethical. And we have the ability to be electing in better people, and we need to be turning out and doing that. It's inexcusable. it's not too late to turn this around. There are very smart, capable people in all of the various agencies. They just need to have the leadership that has the guts and the foresight to be doing the right thing for the people of Florida.
You know, Jackie, I had on the show last week Susan Shetterly, and she's written this beautiful book on wild seagrasses. And it's really fascinating because she goes, you know, she's from Maine, but she has been all over the country and the world, but particularly this country. And she talks about, you know, the beauty of them, number one, but also the number of instances where there have been these terrible crashes, so to speak, from something stupid, if you will. And just, you know, you have the chain where you have the orcas were coming in and going after the baleen whales, and then the whales, you know, etc. And so they were reduced. Why did they lose all their seagrasses? And they were just left with the urchins. And it's that kind of an incredible, beautiful, if you will, food chain. And we're a big part of that. And you, whether it was there in California or what happened in Maine or what's happening here, and you've got this wild beauty, but at the same time, you have kind of a willful disregard and kind of a capacity that when is too much, you know, how much is enough? And I think it really requires us to be really far more vigilant, and not just vigilant, but the sense of, you know, I think the native people have it right, the seventh generation down the line. You know, we've got to be thinking about that, and you know, where we've got it right now with the green ooze and the red tide, and you know, that do we need a hurricane to disperse it? You know, I mean, I hope not. And do they get much worse after hurricanes? All those kind of things. And to me, it was just terrible that they stopped the monitoring stations. You know, there when you know, if you don't have the data. It wasn't just an expense. It's almost like you don't want to see what you don't want to see. So if you don't monitor it, hey, it's not there. And again, it's pretty reprehensible when you have this kind of carnage that I think we have now. So anyway, I really want to thank you for all your efforts and all what you're doing. And are there any events or anything that you particularly want to call attention to people coming up?
Gosh, you would ask me that.
you know I would have.
Yeah, let's see. So, well, you know, in general, we have an event the second Wednesday of the month down at the Ale and the Witch in St. Pete, where we invite an environmental speaker. So you can find more information about that on our website at biologicaldiversity.org.
Yeah, you people do really good work.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate all you do. And also the whole web of life that's involved in that. To me, that's very beautiful. So I really want to thank you for coming in and doing all the work you're doing. And keep up the great work.
Thank you.
And I just posted your website on our Facebook page, so hopefully people will link to it.
And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. This is From a Woman's Point of View, and you just heard Jackie Lopez. And in a few minutes, I'll bring up on the phone Jessica Mason Piccolo, and we'll be talking probably mainly about Brett Kavanaugh. So anyway, okay, so thanks again, Jackie, and I'll put this music on, and then we will continue. his music down. I do agree that every person is a beautiful soul, but I am really glad to have the beautiful soul I have with me on the phone line right now, Jessica Mason Piclo, hard-driving attorney in law, legal analyst, and she's in, vice president in charge of the law and legal policy with Rewire, that fabulous website. I do hope you're aware of it and you go to it. It has so much great information. And so anyway, Jessica Mason Piclo, welcome so much to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for that lovely intro as well.
Well, you deserve it, Jessica. You know, we just got done talking to a terrific person, you know, about the blue algae down here and the red tide, and we're already ticked about that. And I'm looking at, Brett Kavanaugh and just getting really nervous because, as I understand it, Mitch McConnell's schedule is that right after the Labor Day break, he wants to have 3 or 4 days of testimony, and he thinks it could be wrapped up, and I think this is really pretty alarming.
Yeah, I mean, we are moving at such a ridiculous pace that it's really kind of breathtaking. I mean, let's put some context on it. So Brett Kavanaugh has a long and illustrious career in public service. He's quite an accomplished a gentleman, and part of that includes time in the Bush White House during some very formative years for policy in this country. And Chuck Grassley has taken the position, and the Republicans have gotten right in line with him, that that is information that the public is not necessarily entitled to, that we don't deserve to see Brett Kavanaugh's thoughts on executive power, for example, and whether or not he thinks the president can avoid a subpoena. There is a constitutional process that dictates how nominations proceed through hearings and confirmation, and the Republicans are making a mockery of that process and thus the Constitution.
Well, and I'm thinking of the difference with Eleanor Kagan and, you know, with all of her extensive work, you know, that they demanded time to review all this. But I'm also thinking of Merrick Garland, and they wouldn't even talk to him, you know. But Jessica, you just mentioned, because Brett Kavanaugh, to me, is a product of these times, if you will, particularly, you might say, the radicalization, I would say, of the Republican Party, and essentially the loss of what I consider Republicans to the moneyed interest groups of the Koch, etc., and the disdain for government, the disdain for politics, etc. You know, he's kind of been the choir boy, if you will. There he was back, you know, with Starr, Ken Starr, you know, checking into Clinton. And frankly, you know, almost the embarrassing impeachment process that was. And he was the one that wrote up those papers. And I read through them again last night. And, you know, honestly, they were embarrassing. I mean, at least until we got to now, because I find most of the time this president is embarrassing in much more serious ways. But then, you know, then he's involved in the contested election with Gore and Bush. And, you know, illegally, they get it up to the Supreme Court. And then he goes into the Bush administration, and he's involved, you know, in torture. To me, the worst aspect of it, it's bad enough if you're involved in torture, but to me, I hold a special disdain for the lawyers who were told, make it legal. And to me, they were just about as bad, in my opinion, as you can get. And to me, the Gorsuch and the Brett Kavanaughs and the others who were involved, and you out in California now, Berkeley, that, quotes, made it legal for the president to believe he could do this, I thought that was really a severe impact on the morality of this country. And now, you know, he's in the second court, and I mean, so to me, he represents even more than just a nomination. He's almost been, to me, a created being, you might say.
That I couldn't agree with you more. And Mary, I think you just really very clearly articulated the case for your listeners as to why we need to have serious and thoughtful hearings about this nomination, as opposed to just this shadow theater that the Republicans are trying to put on.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, this country pushes come to shove in every single way. And, you know, that rather it's the problem of our blue-green algae and the red tide here, which is all of us concerned, and you see it's so many years in the making. And but we've had, you know, we have pretty much lost our democracy. I mean, after the involvement of the Russians, frankly, it's very obvious, you know, in the last elections they were involved. How much it affected, we don't know. But now we realize, you know, that I'm learning an awful lot about cybersecurity, Jessica. No, you know, and I've realized, you know, now.
I think we all are.
Yeah, and with the implants and the malware that, you know, that when Senator Nelson says they're running free, I hate to say it, he's most probably right. And we don't know what that running free means. And if somebody can screw up our elections, we've been had, so to speak. I mean, that's the basis of this country is representative democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And then there with Brett Kavanaugh, you know, that Nancy McLean is really going around the country trying to warn people, look out, you know, this constitutional convention, which could be had. But, you know,
yeah.
I wasn't aware of the 17th Amendment until she brought attention to it. That, you know, that to me, I just can't believe this is, you know, the 17th Amendment for people, if they don't, you know, remember their constitution that well, you know, that before the state legislatures appointed the senators. And mm-hmm. then it was changed so we could elect them, and they want to repeal that amendment. And you think, whoa, what is this? This isn't states' rights. So what is happening here, Jessica?
Well, so that's really interesting, because that's like an area of constitutional nerdery that I could talk about forever, which is the conservative relationship to electing senators in this country. But I think the history is important, and I'll be very succinct. So, before we elected senators, they were chosen, as you summarized. And this was actually a function of the Confederacy and the desire to maintain local, in particular, white control and representation in D.C. So at the time, you know, this goes back to the darker days in our country's history when being a member of the Klan was something that was required on your resume in certain parts of the country to actually rise up the ranks of political power. And we broke that process in part by the 17th Amendment and the direct election of senators. So I think it's very interesting that at this moment in time, Republicans are pushing to go back to that. And it makes sense if you think about not just the like blatant racism and nativism that's going on, that's fueling the worst of that, but this would happen after an extensive decades-long gerrymandering campaign that has effectively created supermajorities, you know, Republican supermajorities in many states that are almost electorally impossible for Democrats to crack absent a new redistricting plan. So this is about seizing control of power while they have the means to. I think they realize that public opinion is not with them. And so what they're doing is invoking all of the tools that they have as a means to try to retain as much power and insulate it from resistance and, you know, even a change in control.
You know, I think that is fascinating. I'm going to have to bring out your constitutional nerdality a lot more, because I think it's fascinating. But, you know, you just really, I think, made a really important point. And you kind of wonder, you know, what is the mastermind principles behind this? Is it a Coke, or is it deeper than that? Has he assumed this? But, you know, that they know their minority. And, frankly, they know if they really speak out and talk straight what they have in mind and what they're doing, they wouldn't get to second base. But I think it's important for them to use and to take the attitude that they are a minority, that they are a minority that really knows the truth, really knows the meaning of the Constitution, and it never was intended to be this democracy with all these riffraff running around, you know, making choices that they don't know what they're doing. I think they have a disdain. No, I do, and maybe I'm being unfair, but when I see what they do to children, what they do to poor people, what they do to people, period, to me, that's very disdainful. And I think that it's actually almost essential for them to be a minority, because then that can be associated with being elite.
Mm. That's a really interesting point. And it also, if we take your theory one step further, it reinforces the persecution complex that's so deep within the evangelical power base on the right as well.
Well, and, you know, also, I know an area that's so important. And again, I'm talking to Jessica Mason Piclo, and she is VP of Law and Public Policy with Rewire. And they are, it's just a fascinating website. Anytime I go, and I go there pretty regularly, I am just really interested in all the subjects they are involved in. And I know a very big part of that, and I'm thinking of that right now with immigration and the separation of those parents and the mothers from their children and what's going to happen to those children. I mean, to be so utterly disdainful that you would take a child from a mother and you don't know, quote, you don't really have all the data to put them back together if you ever so intended. Well, I mean, I don't know what could be much more bald face in your face, so to speak, that we don't care and that we can do this and we are doing this, and a total disdain because, you know, another important thing, and I'm going to bring out your constitutional nerdality here, is the difference between persons, what the Constitution says. It doesn't say citizens in many instances. And last time I looked, these people are persons.
Yeah, I mean, my colleague Imani Gandhi wrote a really fantastic explainer of this area of the law. Because people don't seem to understand that the Constitution applies to people beyond just U.S. citizens. The Republicans and conservatives are doing everything that they can to narrow that to make sure that the constitutional guarantees of, due process and all privacy, all of them that they are reserved for only a select few, right? We hear that in conversations about removing birthright citizenship, which is a cornerstone foundation of this country and our representative democracy, that no matter who you are or where you come from, if you were born here, you are a U.S. citizen, and the Republicans are attacking that. And this is about changing demographics for them. This is about, as you said, a group that wants to be seen as elite, but also the reality that there are fewer and fewer folks who identify as conservative, white, wealthy property owners, mostly male. And that's what we're really, when we get to the nugget of the matter, that's what we're talking about.
Well, it's really fascinating times. I mean, it really is that some things you think are the bulwark of your society or that almost your whole living environment, so to speak, you realize that in a flash can be changed utterly. And to me, that's frankly what Brett Kavanaugh represents. You put him with Neil Gorsuch and also the, Roberts and Alito and, Thomas, who are already there. We will have a Supreme Court that will, I think, be not at all reflective of the majority of people in this country for decades in the future. And you kind of worry what that future will be for this country.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I think it's also, I'm certainly not one to be overly optimistic, but I think, one bit of context that is helpful here is the reality that the Supreme Court has never really looked like or reflected the majority of the population. It's always been the most elite institution in this country and staffed by the ranks of the most elite pools of talent. And so in that sense, this, while distressing and while this is going to be one of the most conservative courts that we have seen in the history of this country, and we really are entering into a new and different era of judicial conservatism that's as radical, if not more so, than the Lochner years, that this democracy in this country has often thrived and in the face of that. And so don't count the people out, although what the challenge that we have in the landscape that we have is absolutely very sobering.
But here we have Brett Kavanaugh, who obviously is kind of likes in the sense of an imperial president, even though he obviously didn't hesitate with that, with going after Clinton. But I guess he got enlightened with that policy and decided that, oh, well, you know, the president can't be bothered. They've got so many things in their mind. And here you have, you know, challenges coming up with the legitimacy of Mueller, you know, as a special counsel. And you could very readily see that going to the Supreme Court. And, you know, that I happen to think the investigation were the Russians, you know, complicit at all in involvement, even though what I know about cybersecurity now, it would be difficult to think that they weren't when you look what was happening. That to me, this is a pretty major area in this country.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the idea that Republicans are just going full speed ahead with nominations and confirmations to some of the most powerful positions in this country while we have a president who is under active investigation for collusion with a foreign power and election meddling is beyond believable, but that is exactly where we are at.
It's pretty amazing, really. And tell me, Jessica, because, you know, again, I really appreciated Jody Jacobson, your editor-in-chief at Rewire. I think she's amazing. And I have been following, and she's obviously just reached the end of her rope, so to speak, in really dealing with all this. Mm. But I found it was fascinating because I think, you know, the whole business, and of course, when we can't even get the records of Kavanaugh, you know, as many times in various administrations, which have been so important, so we can have time to study it. But the decision of Kennedy to, resign at this point, that he's going to retire, and the influence of perhaps his son, you know, who was a big loaner with Deutsche Bank, that one of the big ones that credited Trump in so many of his actions. And was there any, you know, involvement before this that Kennedy decides? And then, you know, that when she was talking about, what's his name, Judge Kozliak, and I thought, you know, this is getting so sickening to read this kind of stuff, you know, behind the scenes, because you kind of have to expect there is a certain degree of moral integrity. You have to hope there is, and you don't want to even get down in that kind of a pit and start to fight. But it's bothersome, I think, and it's just kind of going unnoticed and unattended. And you kind of look at this morality of this country, and it's to me, it's not accidental that I have thought for a long time that our morality is like how many angels in the top of a pin, and it's based on the backs of women, you know, their bodies and their morality. And so they say, bad, bad woman. But meanwhile, anything else goes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of those things. I mean, I am not a believer that there's some grand conspiracy with Deutsche Bank and Kennedy. But what I think
darn.
We see is that there is a elite and very select few group of powerful men, and we need to be very specific because it is men who run in these same circles. And some identify as Democrats, some identify as Republicans, most seem to be conservative, but, you know, there is a soup. And so, you know, like Deutsche Bank, that's an enormous entity. And, you know, Kennedy's son is in, you know, these elite circles, but of course he is, because his father has been in one of the most elite institutions for the entirety of his career. You know, I mean, Kavanaugh clerked for Kaczynski. He also clerked for Kennedy. Dahlia Lithwick clerked for Kaczynski. Like, this is how the most elite of the upper echelons of the legal community operate. And what I think is important in that conversation is that it is absolutely not reflective, nor is it often operating in the best interest of the vast majority of the country, because the vast majority of the country will never have access to the keys of power that these people hold, and that is very intentional. So that's the conversation I think that is really interesting and should be happening.
Well, it is happening on Rewire, and Jessica Mason Piccolo is one of the many really brilliant minds that's not afraid to really look in and delve in these truths. And you mentioned your colleague, Imani Gandhi, and you guys do the podcast. Is it Lawyering? I can't remember the name.
Lawyered.
Oh, right. And so I just strongly suggest you people go to it because it's just loaded with information. So, Jessica, anything we didn't mention that you particularly wanted to get out today?
I just think that it is important that, folks, I think they do appreciate just what's on the line with the Kavanaugh nomination, and that regardless of, your political affiliation, that you just take a moment and think about what the country is about to do if we rush through with confirmation and nomination hearings. And this is a sobering moment and one that I think everybody should agree. There's no reason why we can't walk it slowly. Republicans taught us with the Merrick Garland nomination that the Supreme Court can function just fine with 8 justices for a duration if it needs to, and I see no reason why that should be any different here.
And, Jessica, we just found out that, unfortunately, Aretha Franklin died, and I'll bet you were a huge fan of Aretha. Anything you anything you want to say?
I just think that, when we look to the real moral compass and leaders of change in this country, it has so often been Black women at the front of that, and they are so often the ones who get none of the credit and all of the derision, and I can't think of someone who probably in some ways exemplifies that more than Aretha Franklin. It's a real loss for us. But, her contributions to music are, undeniable and widely reported. Her contributions to civil rights in this country is also a thing of beauty and grace, and we're all better for it.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica. Very well said. You expressed my feelings very well. So anyway, thank you so much, Jessica. I know it's early out there in Colorado for you, so I do hope you enjoy the rest of your day. I really appreciate your giving us this time today.
Oh, thank you so much, as always, for having me. It's always such a pleasure.
You take care. Bye-bye. And Arlene, that's Jessica, as usual, was brilliant. But also, it's sad news about Aretha Franklin.
Right, and with so much, I don't know what to call it, except scary news on the horizon, it's sad that we're losing Aretha at this time.
Well, I'll tell you, I've learned a lot about cybersecurity, and we are going to be pursuing that. We also are going to be pursuing the lead in the schools. I'm very concerned about that. And there are actually some pretty quick remediations that Dr. Lynn Ringenberg is really pushing for, and I know that Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha in Flint does too, and they brought them in Flint. These source of use, so to speak, filters, which will take lead out, and it's something that I think needs to be considered in the schools and perhaps in homes, but particularly with young children, these filters do work. And so, meanwhile, when you're getting the pipes changed, don't expose the kids. There are things we can do. So, anyway, Arlene, do you have any announcements?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Support for WMNF comes from our members and WEDU PBS. WEDU will honor nonprofit organizations and volunteers during the WEDU Be More Awards. Applications and nominations will be accepted beginning August 30th. Information is online at wedu.org/bemore. And, of course, while we're mentioning that, we also don't want to forget that this Sunday, WMNF will be honoring
Homegrown Heroes. I think that's outstanding. It's such a wonderful idea. Come and meet them and become one. And so I think it's only appropriate today that we go out with the great one herself. And so you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. So let's go out with Aretha. And thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for Rob. And just keep it here. You've got to learn what you need to know here.